So the title of this talk is The View, The Practice and The Fruit. The View, The Practice and The Fruit. And first of all, some opening comments. There's a kind of problem with our retreats. Padmadaka, who's very concerned about our annual programme, asked me, well, I said I'd like to do a retreat on the Bodhisattva Ideal. And a while ago, he said, well, what are you going to do? What can we tell people when they book for a retreat? And I think on your booking form, you might have had something said about a text by Langri Tangpa on the eight verses of mind training and Tonglen meditation. Now, we might be doing something on that, but at the time, I think I said something like that. But actually, because of the way things are, that isn't going to be the theme of this retreat. I seem to be personally in a mood where advanced sort of ideas, you know, ideas months ahead. I might say something now, but when I actually come to it, I'm in a different mood. I'm in a very kind of organic space at the moment. So sort of thinking and planning ahead, it just doesn't work. So, you know, if I say to you, well, I'll, you know, in 2 weeks' time I'll be doing this, probably in 2 weeks' time I won't be doing that particular thing. So just a little tip you off, I'm going through one of those kind of organic phases. We will look at material from the eight verses of mind training, because there's some particularly good stuff in there, particularly associated with Kshanti Paramita. And we might well do some sending and receiving meditation, Tonglen meditation, as the retreat goes on. But I want to deal with some other things beforehand. The retreat is definitely on the Bodhisattva ideal. Ideal not as something incredibly distant, although, of course, it is a very profound and sublime ideal. And let's not pretend that we're all bodhisattvas really, aren't we? And we're all enlightened and all that sort of talk, which seems to be very popular at the moment. That is not the case. It's something we need to be very humble in relation to. At the same time, we're not looking at the Bodhisattva ideal as something that's incredibly distant, that oppresses us. This is very important. Some people find this word ideal difficult as somehow something oppressive that kind of hangs over them. Sangharakshita, Bhante, I'll call him Bhante, actually, not Sangharakshita, because I have to use the term of respect. Bhante, he's always been very careful when he's used the word ideal to say that it's more like a guiding principle at the centre of our lives. That's what a spiritual ideal really is. In that sense, the goal, the ideal, is in us now. It's a guiding principle. That's guiding our lives now. If it's something very oppressive, then it's an idea, not an ideal. Very different thing. So we're looking at the Bodhisattva ideal in the sense of a guiding principle that we're living from, living out in our lives, leading to the transformation of ourselves and our world. So why the Bodhisattva ideal? Well, personally, the Bodhisattva ideal has been a continuous source of inspiration and motivation for me from when I first encountered it. It's been probably the thing that I felt most inspired and motivated by from the very first time I came across it, which was probably in Lama Govinda's books originally, but not long after that, only months, probably even weeks after that, it was in Bhante, listening to that Bhante's lectures on the Bodhisattva ideal, which are printed up now in that book. I forget the proper title of it, but it's the lectures based on the Bodhisattva ideal. But the original lectures I found completely thrilling, moving, inspirational, and extraordinarily rich. Sometimes people say to me, because compared with some people in the FWB, and maybe many people, I seem to have quite a good Dharma knowledge, and I seem to have quite a good memory. And they say, well, what's the sort of basis for your Dharma knowledge? What do you think, you know, what do you recommend? And I always say, Well, if you know everything in Sangharakshita's Eightfold Path series and Bodhisattva Ideal series, you know everything you need to know. If you get the stuff in that, you really get it in yourself, you know everything you need to know. You don't need any more than that. I really believe that. In the first lecture in that series, he talks about the origins of the Bodhisattva ideal, but in a very interesting way. It's really a talk about the Buddha. And he makes the point that people were moved more by what the Buddha was than by what he said. And in that lecture, he tells some of the favourite stories, as only Bhante can tell them, about the Buddha's different qualities, his love of peace and stillness and meditation, about his wisdom and his incredible, incisive insight, about his energy, and above all, of course, he tells of the Buddha's kindness, his love and his compassion. And I think it's very important that Bhante starts with the Buddha. Really, the Bodhisattva ideal is the Buddhist ideal, and the Bodhisattva path is the Buddhist path. And I'm not being sectarian when I say that at all. It's simply to do with the fact that the ideal of wisdom and compassion is common to all Buddhist schools. Whether they formally describe themselves as following the Bodhisattva path or the Mahayana path or not, no Buddhist school would say that enlightenment is anything other than wisdom and compassion, than wisdom and love. No Buddhist school would repudiate it, whether they're Theravadin, whether they're Shin, whether they're Zen, whether they're Tibetan Tantra, whether they're Japanese Tantra, whether they're Pure Land, whatever school you want to describe, in one way or another, all Buddhist schools are about the realization of wisdom and the development of great compassion. So what we have here is, we could sort of retitle the retreat the Buddhist ideal, or even the path of the Dharmachari. We could just as easily do that. The cultivation of awareness and loving kindness for all is the essence of all true Buddhist practice. So on this retreat, we're not beginning. You can discuss this if you like, but I don't propose getting into discussions about Mahayana and Hinayana and all that. What I want us to do is to look at how to live a life dedicated to the development of wisdom and compassion. And another thing that impressed me very deeply in Bhante's lectures on the Bodhisattva ideal was his lecture on the arising of the bodhicitta, the awakening of the bodhi heart, as he called it. And that lecture really evoked the mystery and the wonder of bodhicitta, for me, at any rate. I was just spellbound when he quoted Nagarjuna on bodhicitta and unpacked some very pithy words of Nagarjuna. I'll talk a bit about that tomorrow. I felt a deep resonance with that for some reason when he talked about the bodhicitta being a transpersonal, a suprapersonal force of wisdom and compassion, erupting in one, taking one over, as it were, so that then one worked for the good of all. Fantastic, absolutely wonderful. I wanted that to happen to me. And when I was ordained, and I was only 19, and with all the naivety and innocence and freshness of a 19-year-old, I thought that, if I just do my practice every day, surely within about 2 years, the bodhicitta would take me over, and then I would just spontaneously work for the good of all out of wisdom and compassion. I'm still waiting, 25 years later, 27 years later. Later on, after this particular lecture series in seminars, Bhante began to speak of the bodhicitta as a force arising in and pervading a community, a spiritual community. If the bodhicitta is no one person's personal possession or attainment, it is, as it were, something shared and more, if you like. The bodhicitta arises not only out of intensive individual practice, but out of intensive interaction between those individuals intensively practicing. It arises to produce something greater than the sum of their parts, the sum of their individual efforts. So you're talking about the spirit, if you like, the profound spirit of a spiritual community. And bodhicitta, in this sense, is the aspiration of the Western Buddhist order, or Trilokya Bauddha Mahasangha, as we call it in India. This is the spirit of the order, the ideal spirit of the order. Personally, I see the order as an attempt to manifest among us, between us, the bodhicitta, wisdom and compassion, the force of wisdom and compassion. And I know that I share that vision with many, many other order members, if not many, many other order members, then all order members. So the order in this sense is not an organisation, and it's not a support group. We know that Sangha is very, very important to support our practice. It's very, very difficult to develop on our own. But the order's much, much more than that. And it's very important when you're, you know, the fact with you thinking of wanting to join the order, of asking to join the order, that you realise it's not about joining the order just to be supported in your practice. It's about participating in something to bring alive the bodhicitta amongst us. In that way, Sangha, spiritual community, is our practice, is even our insight practice, our bodhicitta practice. We want the force of wisdom and compassion to take us over within the order. And of course, the related idea to this is the symbol, the image, the archetype of the order, which Bhante says is nothing other, symbolised by, imaged in, the 11-headed and 1,000-armed Avalokiteshvara. That's what the order is trying to manifest, this kind of consciousness which is transpersonal, and yet everybody is individually, uniquely who they are, but in perfect harmony with one another, manifesting wisdom and compassion for the benefit of all beings, and moving out to benefit more and more people. The FWBO is at its best an attempt to express that. Now, I know that we're not always up to that. We're often very, very far away from these ideals, but that is what we are about. Deep down, that's what we're about. And I'm very conscious in speaking of all these ideas, of presenting all this vision, I'm very conscious that none of these are my own ideas. None of these come from me. They all, I have enthusiasm for them, and I resonate with them. I have a feeling for them, but they all emanate from Bhante, from Urgyen Sangharakshita. And in his own life, from a very young age, he's been inspired by the Bodhisattva ideal. First Dharma book he read was the Diamond Sutra. And the Diamond Sutra is nothing other than a description of the Bodhisattva ideal from the most profound perspective possible, the perspective of the Prajnaparamita that cuts like a diamond. And, you know, all the very early on, he was inspired and sustained by the Bodhisattva ideal. And it's worth reading some of his autobiographical writings to see how much he felt for the Bodhisattva ideal. He wasn't just leading the Buddhist life. He doesn't just lead the Buddhist life for himself. It's never been a purely personal, individual pursuit. He's always realised the importance of communicating it to others, of sharing it with others, and giving others the opportunity to practice the Dharma themselves, to follow the path, to live a creative life. And I have no doubt that his life is an exemplification of someone attempting to follow the Bodhisattva path. That doesn't mean he's a perfect person or anything like that, but he's certainly the nearest person I've met, I've had a lot to do with, who I would say, you know, the nearest I've met to a Bodhisattva. And for myself, I have immense gratitude to Bhante. I have immense gratitude to him for many, many things, but in particular for introducing me to the Bodhisattva ideal, not as an idea, but as something vital and alive, something that I can do now in my time and in my place, you know, bringing it from, you know, a medieval context, the context of medieval India, China, Tibet, into the modern world, something that I can actually live as somebody born in the 20th century and living now in the 21st century. Now, although the Bodhisattva ideal is so important, and it's implicit in everything we do, in all the retreats that we do, I can't recall devoting a retreat for many vast for ordination to this particular theme, certainly in recent years. And I think it's high time that we did that, and high time that we made this a kind of regular retreat where we explore the Bodhisattva ideal from all sorts of angles, in all sorts of different ways. It's an extremely rich tradition. There's all sorts of ways into it. And why is that? Well, first of all, it's intrinsic importance. It's just so important to really take this approach in. I think one of the reasons why it's so important, because it really is explicit about the altruistic dimension of spiritual life. It makes it very clear that there is no spiritual development without selflessness, without an opening out to other people. And I think it's, you know, the main, really the only Buddhist myth, picture of the path that really makes that clear. And, you know, self-centeredness in its different forms, in its different refinements, I think is one of the things that can really, you know, bedevil spiritual practice, Buddhist practice. But also I think it's important to talk about the Bodhisattva ideal because of the state of the order and the FWBO. There's been a lot of change in recent years. I mean, there's been a lot of change actually since 1967 when Sangharakshita founded it all. But in recent years been a lot of particular kind of change, all really associated with Bhante withdrawing from things and handing over to the order, the people that he's ordained. And, you know, with that there's been all the different controversies and all the different things said. And it's certainly created a time of quite a bit of turbulence, certainly for some people. And we also want to emphasise a much more of an individual approach to spiritual life, especially the journey one makes to ordination. There are more preceptors, more and more private preceptors, more public preceptors. And, you know, we're saying to people, well, you hook up with a preceptor and you kind of work out with them the way you want to approach the Dharma. And this is all very, very good. It's very good that people can... it's not a question of just deciding for yourself. It's really something you're going to do in dialogue with your preceptors and spiritual friends because, you know, we're a spiritual community. So you in a way, it's not quite simply a matter of, well, I'm just going to do it my way. There's going to have to be some kind of coincidence with somebody, otherwise you never get ordained. But I think when one emphasises an individual approach, because of individualism, which I think is a particularly strong problem, I think, in the modern world, in the modern age, I think there is a great danger of losing sight of the altruistic dimension of spiritual life and the whole dimension represented by spiritual community. If you lose the altruistic dimension, if you lose the profound vision of spiritual community, if you lose that, you lose spiritual life, you lose the Dharma. What you have is a refined form of self-centeredness. And there's plenty of versions of personal development which, you know, they're probably good and useful, but they don't go far enough. And the order really represents, I think, something rather different. I think also because of all this change and variety, if you like, that's appearing, which is a good thing, we need a deeper sense of what really brings us together. What holds the order together? What binds, as it were, the order together and the FWBO together, has never been and can never be structures and institutions. Not that they're unimportant. We're in an institution, we're in a structure now. This takes organisation to put a retreat like this together. But that, in the end, isn't what binds us and holds together. It's not having the same ideas. That doesn't hold us together. It's not having sort of doctrinal agreement. That is fairly superficial. It's not about having the same lifestyles. Looking around the room, I know everybody here has, you know, you all have very, very different lifestyles. It's not even about having the same practices in the end. Really, what holds us together has to be a vision of a profound, it has to be a profound transpersonal vision. And it's the bodhicitta that gives, I think, the best expression to that. Actually, this transpersonal vision represented by bodhicitta is no different from going for refuge to the three jewels. But I think the language of bodhicitta draws out the altruistic, non-dual, transpersonal dimension of the individual act of going for refuge very vividly and powerfully. Now, the traditions of the Bodhisattva ideal are extraordinarily rich and varied. Different Indian traditions, developments in Tibet, developments in China, developments in Japan. We could probably include Central Asia. Tibetan Buddhism even carries traditions from Indonesian Buddhism. So we've got a very, very rich and varied world that we could draw from. But I want to sort of start somewhere else, really. I want to begin by looking at a way of considering the Buddhist path. And this is a particularly popular scheme that you find in Tibetan Buddhism. It's based, no doubt, on Indian traditions, but they really go for it in Tibetan Buddhism, of all schools. And in this approach, it looks at the path in terms of view, practice, and fruit, or vision, conduct, and action. View and practice, or vision and conduct, are fairly straightforward. Action and fruit, you'll see why I'm using those two different words as we go through it. Now, these three things are not stages. They're not stages. It's not like Sila, Samadhi, Prajna. It's not like that. But they're really three elements, as it were, that need to be present for an effective spiritual life. Three elements that need to be present for an effective spiritual life. For effective spiritual life, we need, one, a view, in the sense of a clear idea of what life is, of what life is for. If you like, you need a philosophy, though don't take that in the academic sense. So you need a view. Secondly, you need a practice, or practices, not simply in the sense of meditation practice, sitting practice, but practice in the sense of a whole way of life. So conduct is perhaps a better term, a conduct, a charya. A path, a way of life, as in Dharmachari or Bodhicharya. And thirdly, we need, if you like, a vision or an embodiment, an image of the fruits that come from following the path. A vision, in other words, of enlightened activity, hence the word action. Sometimes this is called the glorious deeds of the Bodhisattva. So in other words, a vision of the goal. Something that you respond to and resonate with. So, view, conduct, fruit. So let's look at these three in greater detail. This is something I think it would be really good to explore in your groups. Let's see what you make of this. First of all, view. So this should be something very, very familiar to you. We're in very basic Buddhist territory. If you're familiar with the Buddha's Noble Eightfold Path, you'll remember that its first limb, its first step, is Samyak Drishti, or right view. So right view is regarded as absolutely crucial for Buddhist practice, as fundamental to Buddhist practice. The first sutta of the Pali Canon, of the Digha Nikaya, the long discourses, is the Brahmajala Sutta, in which the Buddha lays bare 64 false views of his day. He kind of lays them bare, wraps them in a great net, the Brahmajala. Brahmajala means something like great net, the expanded net, and shows how these views, these opinions, these attitudes, these drishti hinder spiritual life and spiritual growth. Some of them are very basic and very mundane. Some of them are extraordinarily refined, arising out of misinterpretations of meditation experience. But the Buddha is very, very keen to lay them bare and then say what right view really is. So what is view in this sense? The Sanskrit drishti can be translated as view or opinion. But what's being got at here is not just ideas, the ideas you have about life, although the ideas might be an expression of the view. What's really being got at is something very, very basic. Something like one's fundamental outlook on life. How you might fundamentally see things and regard things. If you like, perhaps you could call it your attitude to life. And of course, this fundamental outlook will find expression in opinions, ideas. Sometimes these will be turned into whole systems of belief, which one has adopted or formed or inherited unthinkingly, just taken on board. And some of you might be thinking, well, I don't have a view, man. You know, I just don't have a view. Let's avoid views, man. Let's get out of our heads and not have any views, not even right views. Isn't it said that, didn't the Buddha once say, the Tathagata has no views? Isn't any view an impediment? Why don't we just go beyond thought? So why view? Why not have a view? Why don't we just go around in a kind of blank state? Well, it's true that the Buddha did say that a Tathagata has no view, and it's also true that he describes enlightenment as being beyond thought. But although the Buddha has no views, what he does have, which we don't have, is vision, a direct, unmediated vision of things as they really are. So he doesn't need views. Because he knows with his being, because he sees directly, he doesn't need views. He can use views, but he doesn't need them. As Bhante said once, very, very beautifully, in commenting on this phrase, the Tathagata has no views, when all the answers are in your being, there's no need to keep them in your head. But the Buddha, even though he had no views, he had vision, he had no views, definitely expressed and communicated his direct, wordless vision of reality in words, in ideas, as views, as right views. And he did this so that we can use these ideas, these views, to see as he saw, to have the liberating vision that he had. He gave us right views so that we can see things as they really are, meditating on these right views, turning these right views into our being, are the way in which we undermine the unhelpful, restrictive views that we hold, which we're probably not conscious of. I don't think you can leap from having wrong views into a state of being viewless. You just won't be conscious of them. You need exposure to right views. You need to exposure to right view. And not just reading books, but somebody in a study group, preferably, really kind of pointing them at you to actually see the views that you actually hold. That's what we need. Right views, you know, right, this is one of the things that used to be extraordinarily irritating about studying with Bhante, doing seminars with Bhante, because he was so strong on right view, so strong on just clear thinking and just being clear, and you'd come out with questions or you'd make a point, and he'd just lay bare the false thinking. He'd just lay it bare for you. And at the time we always used to get frustrated, but actually looking back it was wonderful teaching. It was, you know, probably the nearest thing, you know, some of us would get to being with somebody like Socrates or something like that. Let's look at some basic right views that the Buddha gave us. Very basic one, absolutely fundamental, is that of karma and its fruit. Actions have consequences, moral consequences. If you act out of greed, hatred and delusion, that will cause pain for yourself and for other people. If you act out of contentment, friendliness and awareness, that will lead to happiness for self and other, for you and others. Very, very basic indeed. And it's so basic indeed that when Dada Rinpoche was asked, and of course we have the Stupa of Rinpoche here, when he was asked by, I think, Naga Bodhi, do you want your pupils, your the children of your school to become Buddhist? He said, no, I'll be happy if they know, if they've learnt that actions have consequences. That actions have consequences. That what they do has an effect. So it's that basic. This right view. Very basic indeed. You could hardly be a Buddhist if you didn't have that perspective, that attitude. If you thought that indulging in craving and hatred was spiritual in some way, well, you need to find another spiritual tradition, because Buddhism isn't for you. It really is a fundamental. If you think it's all, you know, everything is just chance or luck or to do with the stars rather than to do with you being a moral agent, then you've really got the wrong tradition and you need to do some thinking. I'm sure none of you think like that, but I thought I'd just lay it on a bit thick. So let's have a look at some other right views. Let's go to the three Lakshanas. This really is basic, isn't it? The three marks of conditioned or compounded existence. All compounded things are impermanent. Very basic. Very important to get this into focus. Everything passes away. Arises and passes away. Whatever has a beginning has an ending. Nothing lasts forever. Whether inside or outside, there is only arising and passing away. You don't need a philosophy degree or a realized guru to show you this. As Dogen said, impermanence is a fact before our eyes. You're born in the morning and you die in the evening. And no amount of intellectual game playing will make this particular truth go away. It's absolutely unavoidable. And I'm mentioning these basic right views because I notice in myself, and I notice in other people, how it's easier to see it in other people. How, you know, things happen, and how you think, crikey, have you ever thought about impermanence? There's just some friends of mine recently going through all sorts of turmoils to do with the affairs of the heart. And you think, well, even just as ideas, you know, things don't last. You can't hold on to people forever. You really sort of wonder. But I have to speak for myself. I was saying to my chapter the other day that, you know, I've been reflecting on impermanence, obviously not enough and obviously not deeply enough for years, but I still find it very disturbing when there's change. You know, especially the sort of changes going on recently, I feel very uncomfortable with it all. So, you know, this is such a basic teaching, but so hard to really get it into consciousness, to really, you know, connect with it. And then secondly, the second Lakshana, all compounded things are painful. This can be easily misunderstood. It's not a denial of pleasure or happiness. It's not saying that pain is real and happiness is unreal. It's more of a drawing attention to the painful, unsatisfactory aspect of experience. Often we don't want to go there. We ignore that. So we try to make the impermanent permanent. Try to make the world, the samsara, work on its own terms for us forever. And you might make it work for a bit. You might be able to kind of mould it for a bit. But it's such elusive stuff because it's so blinking impermanent that our control just breaks down. Our control just breaks down. And the result of that, of course, is pain. It's just terribly painful. So happiness, satisfaction, deep happiness, satisfaction is found only, it said, in nirvana. And before that, in the life that is being lived for nirvana, the life of transformation. The life, I suppose, you could say, that really accepts impermanence and decides to live by it. And thirdly, all things whatsoever are devoid of unchanging selfhood. We all assume that we are a self, or that we have a self, and that other people are selves and they have selves, and that we are what we are all the time, a world without end, and other people are what they are all the time, world without end, and that we're completely separated off from one another, all separate and discrete. But of course, if we were to look deeply, if we were to look, if we were to reflect, if we were to meditate, if we were to look deeply, we would not be able to find in ourselves and other people a permanent and separate self. We won't be able to find that anywhere if we were to really look. If you can find it, please come and tell me. Please come and tell me where exactly it is in your body, or where exactly it is in the world. I'd be very, very keen to know, because you would have found the philosopher's stone. But what the Dharma says is, what the Buddha says is, that there is just a flow of ever-changing, mutually arising conditions. In other words, praticca samuppada, dependent origination, condition co-production. This being, that becomes. On the arising of this, that arises. This not being, that does not become. On the ceasing of this, that ceases. So nowhere in all of this is there a self, a substance. So in the Mahayana, this is described as shunyata, emptiness or voidness. Again, very easy to misunderstand this. It's not saying that there's just, when they say emptiness or voidness, they're not saying that in reality there's just nothing, that we're in some weird vacuum, some nihilistic, you know, black hole. But really, this flow of ever-changing, mutually arising conditions is so, it's actually indescribable. You can't actually describe it. No words can say what is actually happening. If we were to kind of look deeply at one another right now, we wouldn't be able to find words to describe one another. It's completely inconceivable. So what they say is, they use the metaphor of Maya. The whole of existence is just a magical display, a creative display. Maya is a word actually used in art. So it's just a wonderful creative display, amazing and wonderful. You find this in Milarepa's songs, don't you? He's just describing this, you know, the ever-changing conditions arising and coming and passing away. You know, everything like rainbows in space, and he's just amazed, just finds it utterly wonderful, and just sings out of that. With this vision, of course, it means, if you have this vision, it means anything is possible. There's just infinite potential. And this is what the magic of the Mahayana Sutras is really trying to get at. I'm sure you all remember from your Vimalakirti Nirdesha studies, Shariputra suddenly finding himself turning into a woman and turning back again. Well, this is all describing the kind of malleability of existence, illustrating the selfless, interpenetrating nature of life. It's all malleable. Anything and everything is possible. Above all, enlightenment is possible for everyone, for all beings. If everything is impermanent and insubstantial, then it means radical transformation is possible. So these are some of the basic expressions of right view, and it's very important to engage with them. take them in, reflect on them. So in the groups, it would be good to look at view. Look at view. What is your view? How do you actually regard life? Deep down, how do you see life? Are you a materialist? Do you think really all there is just physicality, just matter? You know, that there are really no kind of ethical, you know, considerations at all. Is everything just chance? Is everything permanent, substantial? Do you deep down really believe in a soul? Deep down, do you really believe in God? And think that somebody's going to sort of do it for you? What is your view? Really ask yourself. Not, you know, don't come out with the good Buddhist views, but try to dig around and find out how you actually see things. It might be that you discover, well, actually, I do look at things in a Buddhist way. Well, that would be a wonderful discovery and would give you an enormous amount of confidence if you could recognise that. You know, I'd just give you an illustration. I think there's part of me that really is just a materialist. It just sees life in terms of, you know, materiality, and my conduct, therefore, is just getting what I want from life, and the fruit is, you know, basking in sensual pleasure. I hope that doesn't disappoint anybody, but that is actually the truth. It's not the whole story. So what is your view? And also, what view are you aspiring to? What vision do you aspire to? What expressions of right view, of the Buddha's vision in Buddhist tradition, really attract you, really move you? You know, is it Pratitya Samuppada? Is it simply the impermanence of things? Is it interconnectedness? You know, what really moves you? And try to say why it moves you, and even how you're trying to see things in that way. So we're looking at view not just as an intellectual exercise, but we're trying to talk with one another in your groups about what is our fundamental outlook on the world. If our outlook is, for example, materialistic, that will affect our practice. It will interfere with our practice. I think one of the reasons why people have trouble with meditation is because they have a very materialistic and mechanistic view of themselves and of life. I think that really sort of restricts success in meditation. So try to lay bare how you see things, but also how you would like to see things. Even recall perhaps those moments when you did have a glimpse, you started to see things in quite a different way. For the Bodhisattva, of course, the view is shunyata, the profound voidness and emptiness of all things whatsoever. But as I've said, that's not a vacuum, not a nothing, it's the emptiness of all duality, any distinction between self and other. And because of that vision, he can naturally, selflessly, spontaneously work, which means play, for the good of all. So, have a good look at view. So let's go on to practice or conduct. As I've said, conduct, I'm using the word conduct just in case we associate practice solely with meditation. Sometimes people say, well, you know, I'm really into my practice. And they're talking about their sitting meditation, and that's a good thing. But practice must encompass all aspects of our life, all aspects of our conduct. Yeah, practice needs to be going on all the time, not just when we sit, but when we walk, talk, work, play, think. Whatever we need to do, we do. Whatever we do, we need to practice. Practice, in fact, is the day-to-day, moment-by-moment application of our view to our lives, or the moment-by-moment attempt to see that view, to see as a bodhisattva sees. If we don't practice, our view isn't really view. It's just a set of nice, consoling Buddhist ideas. So ask yourself when you come to the groups, well, what is your practice? How are you trying to practice? What do you do? What meditation do you do? What meditation practice do you do? Do you meditate? Do you meditate? How often do you meditate? What is your ethical practice? How are you trying to apply your Buddhist view in the affairs of daily life? The particular practice that we'll be looking at throughout this retreat, or practices if you like, is that of the six paramitas, the six perfections: dana or generosity, sila or ethics, kshanti or forbearance, virya or vigor, dhyana, meditation, prajna, wisdom. These six paramitas represent the bodhicharya, the way of the bodhisattva, and we're going to be looking at them, I hope, as practically as possible, so that we can start to actually apply these practices, this conduct in our lives. The paramitas represent, one way we're looking at is the application of view to the affairs of daily life, but of course they're also the support for seeing things as they really are, the support for that view. This leads us to the fruit. If we follow the paramitas, we attain the fruit, and the fruit is the extensive, glorious deeds and actions of the bodhisattva. So what does this mean for us? How can this be present in our lives? What the fruit aspect of things in our lives means is really our intuition of, our vision of, our particular vision of the spiritual ideal. The vision that draws us on or impels us forward from within in the form of an actual embodiment. So it could be the Buddha. The Buddha could be your vision of the fruit of practice. It might be the stories of the Buddha from the Pali Canon, just very simple stories. It might be the image of the Buddha seated like this in meditation. It might be one of the archetypal Buddhas, like Amitabha and so on. It might be one of the archetypal bodhisattvas, such as Avalokiteshvara or Tara or Manjugosha. It might be one of the great teachers, Guru Rinpoche, Padmasambhava, Hakuin, Shinran, Huineng, and so on. It could be the general Buddhist ideals, such as the Mahasiddha, the great magician, or the vision of the bodhisattva as the great compassionate hero that you find in some Mahayana literature. Or it could be something like the humble ordinary man of Shin Buddhism, which sounds like a very high ideal indeed, the humble ordinary man. So there are many, many different visions of, if you like, the ideal man, or the vision of the fruit, the embodiment of the fruit of spiritual life in Buddhism. But what we want is a vision, an image of the selfless, compassionate life, the life that expresses the depths of wisdom. So in the groups, what is the image or images or even myths that really move you, that really impel you to practice? Views aren't enough, really. Views, yes, they're our fundamental outlook on things. Practice isn't enough. I'll go into why we need all three a bit in a minute. We need something. We need an embodiment that will really spark us off, that will really impel us to practice. Perhaps it might be the Bodhisattva Avalokiteshvara himself. Avalokiteshvara, as I've said, is the archetype of the order. Avalokiteshvara, in one of his manifestations, is the bodhisattva who represents ultimate spiritual depth, because he's the bodhisattva who gives the Heart Sutra. The Heart Sutra, the essence, is the essence of the perfection of wisdom, which describes in the most essential, stripped down language the deepest, profoundest nature of things. But Avalokiteshvara is also the embodiment, if you like, of ultimate breadth, of vast breadth. So he's depth and breadth. And there's that wonderful myth of the birth, the rebirth, if you like, of the 11-headed and 1,000-armed Avalokiteshvara. Avalokiteshvara took a great vow He was so inspired by the Bodhisattva ideal, so full, if you like, of bodhicitta, that he took the vow that he would never, if for a second, he thought of just his own welfare, of just turning away from others and just doing it for himself. If he just thought of that for a second, may he just break up into 1,000 pieces. May his head split and may his body just break up. And he had that terrible failure. He broke his vow. He did lots and lots, so much Dharma work, going among the people, teaching the Dharma. This is the myth. And then he looked out and he saw that he had hardly touched anybody, hardly affected anybody in the great sea of beings. So just for a second he thought, well, I'll just have a rest. I'll just do it for myself. And of course, this was a tremendous failure. A tremendous failure. He just broke up, just shattered. But of course, because of the power of his vow, it turned into something else. His guru, Amitabha, appeared, who he'd taken this vow in front of, and Amitabha just transformed the shattered being into this extraordinary figure of the 11-headed and 1,000-armed and 1,000-eyed Avalokiteshvara. And we're given this incredible vision of a consciousness that has transcended self and other, that really does bring out interconnectedness and the altruistic aspect of spiritual life. But let's come back to earth. Let's come back to view, conduct and fruit. These three balance one another. We need all three for our spiritual life to be effective. You need view. You need an outlook. You need a perspective. If you're not developing that, if you're not working on that, you don't have direction. You don't have spiritual perspective. You might meditate, you might practice, but you won't have any overall sense of what you're doing and where you're going. And I've seen it with people who haven't really worked on view. They might have been really into meditation, but because they haven't worked on view, they get lost. And then they give up meditation, they give up practice, they go and do something else. Because they haven't developed an outlook. Meditation has been something that they've, as it were, grooved on, rather than being part of an overall direction in life. So you need a view to know where you are and where you're going. In the Perfection of Wisdom, it says, how will the blind men get into the city? And it says, well, the blind men in this case are the five paramitas of generosity, ethics, forbearance, vigour and meditation. They're blind without prajna, without wisdom. So in the same way, on our level, we're directionless without view, without perspective. But of course, view without practice is just a set of ideas, nice ideas, consoling ideas, but that's all. Of course, it could be even worse than that, because you might take some Buddhist views in the wrong way. You might take shunyata in the wrong way as nihilism, that there's really nothing, and nothing matters, and nothing means anything. Reading some Buddhist texts, you could really draw that conclusion if you didn't have, you know, a practice. Or reading other Buddhist texts concerned with Buddha nature, you might get very, very complacent and think, well, there's no need to do anything, I'm already there. But those things will be ideas, because you're not actually practice. So if you have a correct view, that will result in practice. But even view and practice are not sufficient. We need a vision of the fruit of view and practice, a vision of the glorious deeds of a bodhisattva, expressed in an image, a symbol, expressed as the intuition of a myth, of how wisdom and compassion manifests in the world. This myth or symbol or image or whatever it is, this provides the emotional and volitional force for practice, and It expresses the view. This is very important. And a tremendous emphasis, you know, from Sangharaksha. Well, all three of them have been strongly emphasized in his teaching. You need something that really moves your depths very, very, very powerfully. We are beings of imagination. Some people think, well, I don't have an imagination, you know, but, you know, everybody has imagination. You can be sitting here in meditation, supposedly doing the mindfulness of breathing, but your mind, your imagination is somewhere else. You know, it's having sex with somebody or eating an ice cream, which you're going to do later on in the day. So, you know, what you've got to have something, you've got to have an image, a powerful image within you, so that the ice cream and the sex, you know, doesn't win out in the meditation practice. Because unless there's a powerful image, it's always going to be the packet of sweets that wins out in the mind. So the image of the fruit of practice provides the emotional and volitional force for practice and gives an embodiment, a concrete embodiment of the view. Of course, the vision of the fruit is not sufficient on its own. On its own, it can just be a fantasy, a daydream. You know, just painting kind of pretty pictures in our minds of Buddhas and Bodhisattvas is just not enough. That's not going to do it in and of itself. So we need these three things together: view, practice, and the vision of the fruit. And I hope that tomorrow you'll explore these things in some depth and detail and try to as well relate it to see how you can connect whatever view, practice, and vision of the fruit of practice that you have at your best, as it were. How does it connect with the Bodhisattva ideal? Does it connect? It might not connect at all. So yes, it would be very good if you could explore this as much as possible and as truthfully and as honestly as possible. So to really dig down and see what's actually going on.